This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Full of merriment, mischief, and mistaken identity, enjoy this audiobook collection of eight of Shakespeare's most magical comedies, starring David Tennant, Helena Bonham Carter, and Miriam Margolyes.
Nobody marks you.
What, my dear Lady Disdain? Are you yet living?
Start listening to BBC Radio Shakespeare, a collection of eight comedies, available to purchase wherever you get your audiobooks.
Thanks for downloading the In Our Time podcast. For more details about In Our Time and for our terms of use, please go to bbc.co.uk/radio4. I hope you enjoy the programme. Hello. In the small village of Ockham, near Woking in Surrey, stands a church made of grey stone. It has a pitched roof and an unassuming church tower. Parts of it date back to the 13th century. This means it would have been standing when the village witnessed the birth of one of the greatest philosophers in medieval Europe. His name was William, and he became known as William of Ockham. In the following 63 years, William of Ockham managed to offend the Chancellor of Oxford University, disagree with his own ecclesiastical order, and get excommunicated by the Pope. He also declared that the authority of rulers derives from the people they govern, and was so brilliantly reductive with the theories of his colleagues that Ockham's razor remains a philosophical principle today. But why exactly is William of Ockham significant in the history of philosophy? How did his turbulent life fit within the political dramas of his time, and to what extent do we see his ideas in the work of later thinkers such as Thomas Hobbes and even Martin Luther? With me to discuss William of Ockham are Sir Anthony Kenny, philosopher and former Master of Balliol College, Oxford, Marilyn Adams, Regius Professor of Divinity at Oxford University, and Richard Cross, Professor of Medieval Theology at Oriel College, Oxford. Anthony Kenny, William of Ockham was born about 1285. Intellectually speaking, what sort of world was he born into?
Well, it's quite an exciting world. It's about universities are still comparatively new things. They've been going for just over 100 years, the two greatest ones being Oxford and Paris. And Ockham comes to Oxford at a time when Oxford is beginning to take over from Paris, I think, as the centre of exciting philosophical ideas. Ockham was a member of the Franciscan order simultaneously with the invention of the universities. You have the introduction of these new itinerant preachers, begging friars, mendicant friars as they're called, in two great orders, the Dominicans, founded by St. Dominic, and the Franciscans, founded by St. Francis. And probably the best-known medieval philosopher is Thomas Aquinas, who was a Dominican, mainly at Paris. Now you have a succession of Franciscans at Oxford. In the generation before William Ockham, you have John Duns Scotus, who, in my view, it was probably the most brilliant philosopher ever to have taught in Oxford. Scotus had a very elaborate system of metaphysics. And in particular, he believed that in each of us, indeed in every material object, there were two essential elements. There was a common nature, the common human nature which all four of us sitting around this table share, but also an individuating principle. Some people called it a hexietas, a thisness. And my hexietas makes me not just a human being, but this human being. This individuating principle, which became very much associated with Duns Scotus and his pupils, very much excited Gerard Manley Hopkins in the 19th century, probably the best-known modern admirer of Scotus. And Hopkins wrote several poems about the thisness that everything had, whether they were kingfishers or beetles or bugs or human beings, above all.
Doubled things, yeah.
This elaborate metaphysical system, of which I've only just picked up the tiny corner, was quite influential in Oxford when Ockham came, but Ockham didn't like it at all.
Before we get back to Ockham's opposition to Scotus, can you bring in, you say the centre of, as it were, philosophical power, please excuse mm-hmm. the crudeness of that phrase, had moved from the parish, let us say, of Abelard to the Oxford of Duns Scotus. But the umbrella was Aristotle, wasn't it? Can you tell us, is that right? And if so, can you put it in better words than that?
Well, Thomas Aquinas at Paris, who I think was the most efficient Aristotelian scholar of the 13th century, the person most effective in bringing together the Christian tradition derived through St. Augustine and the Church Fathers with the newly discovered, rediscovered works of Aristotle. And the texts of Aristotle, which started out being forbidden in the University of Paris at the beginning of the 13th century, had by now become the standard texts in the arts subjects, in philosophy. But the standard text to lecture on in philosophy was something called The Sentences of Peter Lombard, a collection of authoritative texts with comments. That was what everybody started their lecturing life by lecturing on, and we have from most of the great philosophers and theologians of the age, we have their commentaries on the sentences and works also about Aristotle.
Marilyn Adams, and we don't know much about Ockham's early life, but you probably know more than anyone else. Can you tell us something about his early education, and then Anthony Kennedy's given the background to Oxford, what he did when he got there?
Well, you're right that we don't know much about his early life. We know that he was born in Ockham, and that he must have entered the Franciscan order at an early age.
12.
I think they 12 to 14 years old, and so he would have been sent up to Oxford, at a fairly early stage, because it really covered what you call grammar school, we call high school, as well as university education, college education in those days. He was... He lectured on the sentences between 1317 and 1319, and during that period he was ordained deacon in Southwark Cathedral, which was then in the Diocese of Winchester, it seems, and he was licensed to hear confessions, as the friars would have been licensed to do at that time. So he lectured the sentences during that time, and then at that point... he became a bachelor. He got his bachelor's degree. And then he went to a London study house, probably, where he taught philosophy and wrote a number of works on logic and physics while he was waiting in the queue to take up a position as regent master. That was how you got your MA, by being a teacher, doing a full stint of teaching at the university. But the friars were allowed only one chair each, and so he had to stand in the queue, and John Lutterell was not very much in favor of Ockham, and there were others in the queue, so Ockham waited. And so he waited until 1324, when other events took their course.
Can you tell us about one of the things that Ockham interested himself in, his answer to the problem of universals? What is the problem, and what was his answer?
Well, the problem, the problem is really a problem about whether similarity has to be grounded in identity of metaphysical components. So if each of us is a human being, we're similar, we're maximally similar with respect to being human being, with respect to rational animality. But does that similarity between two individuals, among individual human beings, have to be grounded in a common metaphysical constituent, which we all share? And if it does, then would there have to be another constituent which makes us to be the very individuals that we are, the hexeity, as Tony was saying. And so so that was the dominant theory. It was the theory that had been defended by Scotus, who is the most prominent Franciscan theologian and philosopher in those days. And Ockham argued that the trouble with that theory is that you will not be able to give an adequate account of the connection between the common element and the individuating element, an account that will make a philosophical sense that will avoid contradiction. And for that reason, he denied that similarity needs to be grounded in identity of metaphysical constituent.
Can you say that again in other words, and then tell us how significant that was?
Okay. You and I are both human beings. We're very similar with respect to rational animality. We're both rational animals. Is there something rational animality that we both share? But if there is, since we're different rational animals, there must be something which makes us different rational animals. That would be the hexeity to which we referred to earlier. And Occam says, well, if an individual such as you is composed of the common human nature plus a melicity, which makes you to be mel, right, then we have to give an account of what the connection between human nature and the individuator is. And he thinks that we can't, that any attempts to give such an account will end in contradiction.
And was this proposition thought to be, was it controversial at the time?
It was very controversial in his time, and he argued for it relentlessly. I think it's important to notice that he argues for it on the ground that the contrary views, which he considers at great length, it takes up four different questions of the sentence commentary. The view that he attacks is what he calls the common opinion, and he argues that for it at great length. And he makes a special target of his attack on Scotus, who gave the most coherent and elaborate and sophisticated formulation.
Richard Cross, I understand that Occam's ideas about universals made it difficult to explain the Holy Trinity. Why was that, and how did he get round it?
Well, there are various reasons why this might be the case. I mean, just in principle, if one denies universals, then there are going to be some problems that arise with the Trinity. And in Occam's particular case, because of the particular way in which he denied it, in terms of the inability to explain the connection between what's shared and what's particular. And here's how it goes. Here's the easy case, first of all. And this has got a long history in Christian theology, in fact, before Occam. If you think that there aren't shared natures or shared properties, then it's very hard for you to give an account of how it is that there's just one God, because you might think, well, the Trinity looks like this. There are supposed to be three divine persons. They all share something. Let's call it the divine essence. And in addition, the persons will include some other feature that distinguishes them from each other. Now, if you think that in principle there couldn't be shared essences, properties, or whatever, then it looks like you've almost ruled out the Trinity on philosophical grounds straightforwardly, just from the word go. Put in that way, it didn't quite affect Occam. It's affected other earlier nominalists, and there's a big history of this in Christian theology going right the way back, in fact, to the 4th century. The specific issue with Occam has got to do with the inability of an account that accepts universals to explain how it is that you could have two sort of metaphysical components of one thing. So the problem that arises for Occam is that we have these three divine persons with their shared common nature, plus some other constituent, but we've ruled out, as it were, on philosophical grounds, the fact that there could be two such constituents in any one person. So that's a particular problem for him.
And how does he get round it? It's quite a neat sidestep, I think, the way he gets round it.
Oh, is it? I think he just says, well, in this case, our philosophy can't tell us, you know, it can't be fully generalizable, and theology must be an exception.
That's right. That's a sidestep, isn't it, really?
I suppose it's a sidestep. I mean, it's a particularly unsatisfactory position, I think, for a medieval philosopher to want to adopt, because part of the whole program that they had and that they'd been building up, I think, with some reasonable success, was that whether or not you could show that Christianity was true, you could certainly show that it was coherent and that it's reasonable. And Occam is, as it were, cutting right at the core of that.
Anthony Kenny set us off quite firmly with Duns Scotus. Can you say what it was, briefly, what it was about Duns Scotus that Occam disagreed with and why that was significant?
Well, I suppose it was fundamentally a philosophical thing. In terms of theology, I mean, there are always marginal differences between different thinkers, but theologically I think they're quite close, in fact, and there aren't many places where Ockham radically disagrees with a theological position of Scotus. The real philosophical meat has got to do with really the things that we've been talking about already. Ockham just thought Scotus's position on various things was incredibly wasteful and extravagant, and that we could do without some of the entities that Scotus proposes, as well as thinking, of course, that Scotus's position was in fact unintelligible, which was his real problem. That said, I mean, even on philosophical things, they agreed on a large number of questions. For example, there's a standard Aristotelian analysis of material substances into matter and form, which is used to explain change, so that when something changes, well, it must be in some sense the same thing that persists through the change, otherwise it would, you know, nothing would have changed. And so the idea is that, you know, at the most general level, we can say that there is matter or stuff, and that this persists through various changes, and that, as it were, the changes are explained by different structures had by the matter at different times. Well, there was a great medieval debate about how much reality we should allow to matter and form, so that we might say, in me, there is the matter and the form and me, and that makes three things. And fundamentally, Scotus and Ockham agreed on that against Thomas Aquinas, who thought that you should only count the one thing, me, and that matter and form are just abstractions. Now, but both Scotus and Ockham think that that wouldn't be sufficient to explain the persistence of the one thing across the change. So there they agree, say, against the Dominican Aquinas.
Although, Anthony Kenny, there's no record of Ockham's razor, the phrase being used in connection with his works at the time, it did come in, and it has seemed to be appropriate. How did he exercise this? How did he use this and shave things off with regard to Duns Scotus, or how is he supposed to have done?
Well, I think you're right that his idea was that his predecessors, in particular Duns Scotus, had grown a huge metaphysical fuzzy beard which needed cutting off and they'd get back down to the bare bones of reality. But it was not just his immediate predecessors that he was deconstructing in this kind of way. Aristotle, for instance, had a system of 10 different categories, you know, substance, quantity, quality, and so on. And Ockham thought this was far too many, that all you really needed was substance and quality. And he thought that there was a great deal of incoherence in the notion of quantity, of there being a real accident of quantity, because if you had something gradually growing, this would suggest a lot of tiny little entities coming into momentary existence, going out of existence, and so on. He didn't believe, as Marilyn was talking about, he didn't believe in the universals that were fundamental in Scotus' position, and he had a number of fairly plausible arguments against them. For instance, he said, if the common human nature is present in you, Melvin Bragg, then if you drop dead, all human beings would die too, because the common human nature, which is a part of you, would have disappeared. So we would all flop dead at the same time. He had a lot of clever arguments like that against Scotus. Now, I think that the sort of historical importance of this, not just in philosophy, has to do with the relation between philosophy and theology that Richard was talking about. And you get in Thomas Aquinas, you get a very fine metaphysical structure and epistemological structure designed to show that Christianity is rational, that the highest form of human thought, namely Aristotelianism, is in full accord with divine revelation, and moreover, that human thought can, of its own nature, tell us quite a lot about God, about the world, about ethics, and so on. And Scotus, in a sense, can be seen as pushing Aquinas a bit further, in that he has an even more elaborate metaphysical system, which is supposed to tell us a great deal also about God as well as about the cosmos we live in. For Ockham, not only in the case of the Trinity, but in the case of many Christian doctrines like predestination, the Eucharist and everything, Ockham will tell you there's a tremendous amount of philosophical difficulty in understanding these. And you almost think he's going to say, so we'd better throw over these doctrines. But always at the last line he says, so we cannot explain how this works in any way, but we must believe it on the word of God. I mean, that early treatise that you edited, Marilyn, on predestination ends in precisely that way, does it not?
It does, but I think that one could put this in a perhaps more sympathetic light. That is to say, Aquinas and Scotus had philosophical intuitions and predispositions which led them to formulate conceptual frameworks which they thought accommodated Christian doctrines in various ways. Ockham, coming on as a philosopher, and he was a brilliant philosopher, thought that he could attack their philosophical theories on rational grounds and show them to be incoherent at various points. Those are, of course, controversial claims, but that was what he sincerely believed, and he was certainly entitled to be confident of his own philosophical expertise. So I think it's a methodological issue here for Ockham. If you take reason as far as it will go, what are you supposed to do? Are you supposed to say, oops, Christian doctrine says this, so I'd better modify my philosophical intuition in a way that I've just argued is totally incoherent, or shall I just say, I don't know how to resolve them, but these are two desiderata that must be preserved, and we'll wait to see if we can come up with a more adequate theory eventually. In other words, it's one thing when, as with in a scientific theory, you get new data, and so you think, oh, we need to complicate our metaphysical assumptions. And the medievals all did that with their Aristotelian framework. With the Eucharist, for example, they complicated their metaphysical framework. But Ockham thought this couldn't be because it was contradictory.
Back to the life, I'm going to speed forward a bit here. In 1323, John Luttrell, the Chancellor of Oxford, picked a fight with the Oxford Dons and lost his job. And in order to please the Pope, one of the two Popes, there was a Pope at Avignon and a Pope at Rome there, that's another programme, but there was one at Avignon, he sent his thesis off there, and Ockham was summoned to Avignon to face what seemed to be heretical charges, 56 heretical charges that Luttrell had sent to them. He was eventually acquitted of charge of heresy, although thought to be controversial, which indeed he was. But when he was in, I'd like to come to you now, Richard, when he was in Avignon, he fell into the argument about the nature of the Franciscan order's relationship with the papacy over the issue of wealth and property. Mm-hmm. So we can leave theology behind for a second. We have this brilliant man, not as brilliant as Gordon Anthony as Duns Scotus, but this brilliant man who was attacked by his own chancellor at the university. He was summoned to Avignon by one of the two popes, there were soon to be three, but one of the two popes. He was cleared eventually of heresy, but then he fell in with an argument, a political argument, really, to do with wealth and property, and whether the gospel said that the apostles had held everything in common, and that they had no money, and the original teaching of St. Francis should be followed through. Now, can you tell us how he got involved in that, Richard, and what he did about it?
Okay, well, there's a kind of long background to this, which I'll try to do pretty quickly.
Yeah, pretty quickly, that's right.
Okay, so when the Franciscans are set up, the idea is that they don't own anything. And this turns out to be immediately unworkable, even during Francis's lifetime, because they're set up fundamentally as a preaching order, and in order to have preachers, you need education, and in order to have education, you need some money. And so this kind of rumbles on in the Franciscan order for quite a while. It sort of gets resolved, first of all, in 1279, so a little bit before Ockham, and there it's agreed that, following the teaching of another Franciscan, Bonaventure, that the Franciscans, just like Christ and the apostles, don't own anything, though they can use things. And that gets to say they can use things without owning them. Some Franciscans, okay, so everyone's happy with this, but some Franciscans still want to go a bit further and say, well, if we can use things, then we must put a limit on how much we can use, and we must use the very least possible. to be in accordance with the teachings of Francis. So these are the so-called spiritual Franciscans. They're fundamentally based in the south of France. Now, the Pope in 1323 was John XXII, who had spent a lot of his life in the south of France and was dealing with these rather hippie-like Franciscans who had the further disadvantage of believing a lot of strange apocalyptic prophecies about the end of time and so on, and prophecies which they tended to interpret in a way that was strongly antipathetic to the church hierarchy. So we're down there. That's putting it nicely. I mean, okay, the prophecies, I'll just tell you about that very quickly.
No, we haven't got time.
No time on the prophecies.
Absolutely.
Okay.
The issue is that the difference between the Franciscans' view of the ownership of property and that of the Pope, this becomes a fissure and a political argument,
which
goes into all sorts of other areas.
Yes.
Now, where did he stand on that?
Okay, so what happens is, Occam's in Avignon. John XXII has just said something which seems to overturn the teaching of 1279, which is that the Franciscans have a right to use the things they use. And Occam says this is in conflict with the teachings of an earlier pope, right, Nicholas III in 1279, and therefore that for saying this, because it amounts, if you say you've got a right to use something, that amounts to saying you own it, right, and so it's property, although John XXII very cleverly didn't use the word property here. Occam thought, if you've got a right to use, then that's property, and therefore the Pope has fallen into heresy because he's contradicted the teachings of an earlier Pope. Now, John XXII himself could argue that the teachings of the earlier Pope were just administrative and nothing dogmatic, but at any rate, that was Occam's view.
And in Kenny, so Occam, down there in Avignon, declares that the Pope, having been hauled to Avignon as a possible potential heretic, he declares the Pope to be a heretic.
Yes, that's right. And
quite bold, really.
Yes. It was much more common in the Middle Ages for people to denounce popes as erroneous, heretical, and so on, than it has become in recent years. Even saints like St. Catherine of Siena and so on were quite willing to tell off popes when they were going wrong. Now, Occam, I think the interest, long-term interest of this is that denouncing the Pope as a heretic, Occam reflected quite a bit on the nature of natural rights. He's one of the originators.
The Pope's a heretic. Sorry to interrupt. Sorry. I've been rushing this because there's so much in this. Pope's a heretic because he's denying the fact of the matter, which is that the original persons involved in the foundation of Christianity were, in fact, those who did not want to have wealth and property. And the Pope denies that. And that, in
brief...
Well,
I think the particular point on which Occam was attacking him was that the Pope was denying the distinction between ownership and use. Hitherto, the Franciscan position had been based on the idea that though, following St. Francis, we must not own anything, we can use things. You have to use things in order to live. John the 22nd says this is a bit of sophistry. It's a fudge. And if you can use something, if you have a right to use something, you own it. Well, Occam, it seemed to me, had the better of the argument here. He said if you're a guest sitting at somebody's table, you have the right to eat the food placed in front of you by your host, but you don't own that food. You can't take it home in a doggy bag, as it were. And so the distinction between ownership and use is, I think, well defended by Occam. And he distinguished among the natural rights you have, natural rights that you can't give up, like the right to life, and natural rights that you can give up. He agreed there was a natural right to own property, but by joining the Franciscan order, you gave up this natural right.
Richard, do you want to come back in?
Well, yes, and I think one could probably take it a little bit further as well, in the sense that Occam ties all of this material in to a sort of wider political question about democracy. Is now a good time for that one?
Yes.
Yeah, good. So again, there's a kind of backstory here which we do have to have a little bit of. And so the backstory goes like this. Do we think that political society is natural or artificial? And if you look in Aristotle, for example, he's quite insistent at the beginning of the Politics that it's natural. So that if you have enough people living together in some kind of proximity, naturally you will get some kind of polity out of this. It will just emerge. What the form of that is a different question. And this is very starkly in contrast to the kind of Christian view you might find in, say, Augustine, who really thinks that political society is a consequence of the fall. If Adam hadn't fallen, there would have been no need for rulers and with legislative and executive powers and so on. So in the Middle Ages, you very much find Aquinas defending Aristotle's line. And how he does it is by means of the following very neat theological question. If Adam hadn't sinned, then would there have been a need for political societies or political institutions? And the answer is yes, which is a way of saying that really political society is natural. It's not artificial. It doesn't require the exercise of will or any particular kind of consent or anything like that. Occam, in the light of this poverty dispute, really ends up defending a kind of modified Augustinian view. He certainly disagrees, I think, with Aristotle and Aquinas that political society is natural. And his view is certainly that if Adam hadn't sinned, then there would have been no need for it. Why would there? Because people could just have used things without trespassing on the rights of others, because they wouldn't have been sinful and so on. But in order to protect people after the fall, when people tend to get rather bad dispositions and desires and avarice and such like things is held to rule their or govern their actions, well, then God gave two distinct rights. One was the right to own things, right, property rights. The other was the right, sort of dominion over one's political fate, as it were, the right to elect one's ruler. These two things, I think, in Occam's mind go hand in hand. It's very neat and obviously designed to provoke his opponents, because now we have the Franciscans have given up their property rights. They're like the prelapsarian man. They're like Adam and Eve in the garden. And that claiming that, implicitly claiming that kind of thing for oneself, obviously is designed to annoy, and clearly it did.
I'm a bit puzzled by what you said, because you said that Occam was denying that society, political society, was natural. On the other hand, you said that God had given us a natural right to choose our rulers. Don't these conflict, rather?
Okay, yes, but only as a result of... I mean, you're quite right, but the natural right is only one that, as it were, it's given to us by God deliberately. And so Occam says by an act of positive law.
Sort of add-on.
Exactly, that's an add-on right, exactly.
Thank you.
Yeah.
But you took us, Richard, unknowingly to Munich, really. We've been in Oxford and Avignon in Munich, to which Occam flees when the Pope, he is one way or another excommunicated. He goes to Munich into the arms of Ludwig of Bavaria, who is opposed for his own reasons, the Holy Roman Emperor, is opposed to the Pope, and setting up a court of theologians, including Marsilius of Padua and so on. Marilyn, can you tell us... how Occam enters in what could be called his political dimension as a thinker here, and the arguments he brings to defend the position of the emperor vis-a-vis the Pope?
Well, I think Richard has already begun to touch on
this,
that basically Occam attacks the Pope in Avignon. They move to Pisa. They do not get the consent of the order. They move to Munich, and they live under the protection of Louis. Basically, Occam defends a dualism about church and state, whereas some people wanted to say that the secular authority derives its power from the Pope, and others, like Marsilius, I gather, wanted to say that the church should be subordinate to the state. Occam advocates a parallel system, and he thinks, as Richard was already explaining, that the state is basically, he has basically a liberal view of the state, that after the fall, you wouldn't have to have property ownership if everyone would live by natural reason, but not everybody will, so we can have a state. And basically the initiative for forming a state is from the people. But he was also an advocate of stability. He thought that monarchy was, for various predictable reasons, predictable in England anyway, the best form of government probably, and that once a government is established, there's not a matter, it's not that the people can remove the monarch for just any reason. The monarch would have to do something really egregious for the, but then it would belong to the citizens to remove the egregiously bad ruler. And the Pope might be one of those citizens, and it might be that in a big emergency, he would be the only one organized enough and with enough resources to help remove, but it would not be qua Pope that he would have that authority, but just qua citizen. And on the other side, he wanted to say that the church also, in a sense, exists to promote evangelical freedom, and that he was really against the idea that that there should be a juridical conception of the church in which the Pope's primary responsibility would be to give lots and lots of rules. He argued that the freedom of the gospel is different from the old law, and therefore if you multiply lots and lots of rules and obligations for Christians, then it will be just as burdensome as the old law, and that's not gospel liberty. And that basically the church should be more minimalist in its regulation, rules and regulations, and more pastoral in its exercise of authority, and that as a rule, the state should stay out of church business too. But if the Pope, not just if he's a bad Pope, there are lots of bad leaders, as we know, but if he's heretical, then it might be the role of a Christian ruler to participate in the removal of the Pope. But more the regular or the normal situation is that these two systems go along in parallel. The church is concerned with spiritual affairs, and the state is concerned with temporal affairs, but what's the common thread in Occam's theories of each of them is an emphasis on personal liberty as a real value to be maintained with any body politic, secular or sacred.
Anthony Kenny, was he just serving his master, Ludwig or Louis of Bavaria, whichever name you choose, in genuinely rethinking how political authority might work, or does this, can we see this coming out of the drive of his thinking from the beginning?
Well, I don't think that he was a systematic thinker about politics in the same way as he was a systematic thinker about logic, language, and metaphysics. I mean, certainly what he's left are much more like pamphlets and so on. But I do think that even though it comes out in this more or less informal way, I agree with Marilyn that the system he presents is in many ways a very attractive one. I mean, one can contrast it with what happened at the time of the Renaissance and the Reformation, when you get the glorification of autocratic rulers developing in England into a theory of the divine right of kings, and when you get a counter-Reformation pope with claiming at least absolute authority in all ecclesiastical matters, even if he didn't always succeed in selling this to the Christian kings. It's a much more liberal view in Occam. The Pope is a kind of constitutional monarch, responsible to general councils, and as Marilyn said, can be deposed if he goes into heresy. And the right of monarchs to rule does not come directly from God to the monarch, so that to resist the king is to resist God. It comes from God to the individual citizens, who then pass it on, if they so wish, to a king. I think that, as you say, he has a bias in favour of monarchy, but I didn't think he thought it was the only form.
He gives lots of arguments that that's probably the most useful.
Well, of course, he is at the court of a monarch.
because governments are basically to be justified on the grounds of utility. He argues that they're useful, but...
Richard Cross, how significant do you think these ideas will become in the history of political philosophy?
Well, I suppose one's looking at the beginnings of sort of modern democratic theory, as Marilyn's already said, you know, liberal state, I think I heard you say that, Marilyn.
I did.
Yeah, so something like that. We're looking at the sort of birth around this time of those kinds of theories. And since we've mentioned Scotus, I think I would say that, in fact, he is the origin of all of these. There's a very small, almost throwaway question in Scotus. Must be written about 1305, so before Occam and before Marsilius. where he just says, it looks to me probable that, given that human beings are fallen, they have property rights and they have the right to elect their own legislator, because someone who's going to exercise so much power over them shouldn't be someone who just appears, as it were, in their lives arbitrarily. So in a way, they're all building on a very small, just two-page nothing thing in SCOTUS and developing a load of democratic theories out of this. And I suppose, you know, we get through eventually to Hobbes, who I suppose has been reading Grotius, who I suppose has been reading someone like Ockham, or Marsilius maybe. And so you could argue that right here we're witnessing the beginnings of modern secular statecraft.
Anthony Kenny.
Yes, I think that could be true, though Marilyn would know better. I don't know how widely known Ockham's political tracts were at the time, say, of Grotius.
I don't have the impression that they were as influential. Mm. That's my impression. And it's important to note that he's going for a parallel system. It's not just that the state is independent of the church, but that the church is independent of the state. And I have the impression that theories according to which the church was dependent upon the state or established by the state or something were much more popular in the immediate decades or centuries afterwards.
The ironical sort of end of the story of the quarrel with the Pope was that Ockham, having denounced the Pope as a heretic, lived to see the Pope actually denounced by the Church as a heretic, but for a quite different doctrine, of course. For the Pope John the 22nd had the idiosyncratic view that when a holy person dies, instead of going straight to heaven and seeing God, they're kept waiting until everybody's body is resurrected. This had, besides theological consequences, I think it had financial consequences for the church. Masses for the dead and so on would be a bit of a problem. The Pope was condemned as a heretic, recanted on his deathbed. The formal condemnation actually was the first act of his successor. But the succeeding Pope didn't remove the condemnation of Ockham, and I think when Ockham died of the Black Death, he was still under the ban of the Church, wasn't he?
That's what, as best as we can tell, yes.
Mm-hmm. And finally, and briefly, Richard Cross, do you think that Ockham is most influential for his logic or for his political thought?
I think probably logic would be what I would say, not least because, you know, almost all early modern philosophers were nominalists. And again, it's not necessarily that they are reading Ockham, but the access to the scholastic traditions no doubt fed right into this.
I think Ockham's logic is the next one, Anthony Kenny. I know it preoccupies you a great deal, but thank you very much for putting a quart into a thimble for us. Thank you very much, Marilyn Adams, Anthony Kenny, and Richard Cross. And next week we'll be discussing the extraordinary life and poetry of Sigrid Sassoon. Thanks for listening.
We hope you've enjoyed this Radio 4 podcast. You can find hundreds of other programmes about history, science and philosophy at bbc.co.uk/Radio 4.
Full of merriment, mischief and mistaken identity, enjoy this audiobook collection of 8 of Shakespeare's most magical comedies, starring David Tennant, Helena Bonham Carter and Miriam Margolyes.
Nobody marks you.
What, my dear Lady Disdain? Are you yet living?
Start listening to BBC Radio Shakespeare, a collection of 8 comedies, available to purchase wherever you get your audiobooks.